Shut the blinds, light the candles and the incense, use the hot wax, relax, enjoy My Mac Podcast 126.
The next generation of radio, it's the MyMac.com Podcast.
Hello.
You know, the problem with the hot wax is Chad's kind of a hairy guy.
Ouch! Ow! Ow, don't pull it.
Was that 40-year-old virgin territory?
That's right. My name's Tim Robertson, and Chad Perry is sitting here next to me in Battle Creek, Michigan. Guy Searle is with us. Hi, Guy.
Hey, hey, I'm here.
And we've got a special guest this week.
Special. Robert Hazelrig.
Yeah, I'm special.
I think my toe.
In so many ways.
So, where are you located? Jersey, right?
Yeah, the Jersey Shore.
That makes you special right there.
You live on the Jersey Shore. Does that make you homeless?
he's actually at the public library right now. That's
right. Actually, I'm about 5 minutes west of the beach.
Uh-huh.
So I'm convenient enough to the beach to go on a whim, but inconvenient enough to suffer from the random floodings which we just recently had.
Do you ever kind of break out into a Jersey accent at all?
No, not really. I don't know. Many people think that I'm from New England. I don't know why. I don't talk like I'm from New England, although I do pick up accents when I talk to other people.
Hey,
because you parked the car in the yard.
Hey, I'm walking here. Hey,
yeah, I guess more New York.
Yeah, that's kind of New York.
Yeah, we get a lot of New Yorkers in this area. Unfortunately, everybody from Brooklyn comes down here during the summer and basically.
Dad's from Brooklyn. Watch it.
Yeah. Well, not everyone from Brooklyn is bad. Just the Bennies that we call them Bennies.
Bennies.
The acronym stands for Brooklyn, Elizabeth, Nassau, and something else. I don't know. It's a very old nickname that we've given the summer renters down here.
Well, is that like some of the various regions within the
in the New York area? Yeah.
So Robert usually does the reviews here on the podcast. What have you been playing with lately, Robert?
Oh.
Ooh, he didn't know I was going to say that. I kind of threw it out.
Right. I don't think this is going to be a speedy review.
I should have said, you put the hot wax away for now. We'll get to that later.
Yeah, good thing this is just audio. Yeah. You can't see me here with my hot wax, baby.
Yeah, but you're not supposed to put on your eyebrows like that, Guy.
They're so damn hairy.
I tell you,
I was tired of having one just going all the way across the top of my forehead.
Well, the problem with mine is they go all the way behind my ear, so, you know.
Yeah, kind of like sideways sideburns.
That's right. So what are you playing with, Robert? Wow, that's a loaded question, isn't it? Yeah.
From hot wax to what Robert's playing with, this is not going to end well.
No.
I've been souping up a bunch of machines. I had recently gotten a bunch of older Macs, and actually one of the upcoming reviews I think you're using this week is one of those processor upgrades for an old Rev A tray loading iMac, which I actually stuck a G4 processor in it, and it actually performs pretty well.
Does it run Tiger now?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I did that to, I actually gave that to my 4-year-old daughter. She plays the most updated games that we can get for it. I stuck some Dora the Explorer on there, and she loves it.
He gave it to her originally, and she went, what? A 233 megahertz? Come on, Dad. Come on. Actually, hook me up.
Hook me up, Pop.
Hook me up, Pop.
What's she'd up been, with that?
She'd been...
What is this, 98?
Right?
Yeah.
She'd been asking for one because her sister has one as well, which doesn't have...
She'd been asking for a G4 upgrade?
No, she'd been asking for a computer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I recently got an old APG G4 that I just gave to my wife so she can do our bookkeeping on, and I'm supposed to be getting a processor upgrade for that soon, I hope.
Hmm.
Oh. Yeah, I'm still waiting to hear from Mike Loudermilk from FastMac about, he was going to send me, I think it's a dual processor G4 for this 933 tower I have.
Well, you got to keep on those PR guys, guy. You got to pick up an email application every now and then and fire off one and say, "Hey, what's going on? I send it to
Tim,
me."
Tim, damn it, it's supposed to fall out of the sky into my lap.
That's how it does work sometimes, I swear. Yeah. Stuff just kind of shows up, and you're like, oh, cool. Mm-hmm. Speaking of showing up, it looks like a lot of people are picking up Adobe CS3 right now. Everybody's kind of excited about that, and for good reason. It's probably the biggest jump for Adobe in their software titles in years.
On the Mac side.
Oh, and on the PC side. Look at how many new programs they're including with CS3, plus the purchase of Macromedia, rolling all those applications, or at least some of them, into the CS3 package. I mean, it's a big upgrade.
Well, how much did they change the Macromedia stuff? I mean, they haven't had it that long.
Well, I couldn't tell you. They haven't sent the review copy. They're supposed to by the end of the month. You're getting a copy of CS3 as well, aren't you, Robert?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
So
I haven't gotten it yet, but I did. I actually went to an Adobe conference today online. They have an online seminar. If you go to Adobe Events. They have a bunch of online seminars, and actually it's every Thursday for like the next 6 or 7 weeks, they're highlighting an application. Today, David Blattner did his overview of InDesign, and it was really cool. I'm like itching to get it now. I just have to have it right away.
Now, are those free, or do those cost money?
No, the online seminars are free, so all you need is an email address.
Can
so
you
definitely check it out.
Can you download the previous ones, or is it just live only?
You know what? I'm not sure. The event that I went to was a live event. I don't know if they host it after the fact.
Is it AdobeEvent.com?
It's Adobe.com/events, I believe, is the address.
Well, I'm going there right now to see if... I can't imagine that they would host it for free, and you got to watch it live, and then that's it.
Yeah, I don't know... It makes sense to me to host it afterwards, but they definitely have a live audience, and you're allowed to participate and ask questions, things like that.
Well, I'm going there right now.
Is that done with audio, or you send them a little email clip and they answer your question?
It's all done through the new browser software. They're using an Adobe Connect, so it worked through Firefox. And in the past, the Adobe seminars, you used to have to dial in on the phone, and then you listened to the audio on the phone, and then watched what was on the screen. But now with the new software, everything goes through the browser, which was pretty nice.
They've got just a ton of stuff up there. I just clicked on to their events, their online events, and boy, they've got stuff coming up from Acrobat, Education eSeminars, Adobe Captivate. Mm-hmm. I don't even know what Captivate is. There's all kinds of stuff coming up. So if you're an Adobe CS3 user, or going to be very soon, might get you some ColdFusion MX7 is coming up. So they are definitely using some of the Macromedia stuff as well. That's cool. So why don't you explain to our listeners, Robert, what you do for a living? You don't have to, give the name of the company or anything. We don't want to get you in trouble for being associated with this podcast, but
or the one we'll probably record when we're done with this.
Yeah.
Well, I am a graphic artist. I've been a creative director in the past. I've been a art director in the past. Right now, I'm a graphic production person. I've actually stepped back from my creative roles to just basically sit back and design. I'm tired of doing all the paperwork. So.
Is it packaging design, or is it... billboard stuff or mailings or
cereal boxes?
No, that's what we do, guy. That's oh, okay. Where I consult on a daily basis.
I work in the Princeton, New Jersey area, and I work with a number of large pharmaceuticals.
Uh-huh. There's a dream job.
Yeah, it's actually very good work. It's steady work. It's not, you don't have to worry about pharmaceuticals going out of business,
Well, do they give you free samples?
No.
Okay, never mind.
Yeah. But, basically I'm laying out and designing posters and invitations for large seminars.
Awesome.
It's all event-driven media. On the side, I have a freelance business which generates almost the same amount of income as my full-time job, which is very nice. And I have a couple clients where I do traditional advertising for, you know, billboards, newspaper ads, and magazine layouts and things like that.
And then you're also that retired porn star, right?
Well,
he doesn't want to brag.
Well, you know.
Well, that explains that iBraider review he did a while back. So. Yeah.
Of course, that never made it on the podcast.
Yes, yeah. No, never,
Robert was actually censored on this podcast.
I know.
He sent in a review, and I listened to it, and I went, "What the hell?" I wrote back, "We're not playing this." Oh, man. That's back when we still had, you know.
Not Mac.
I'm still waiting for you to forward me that review.
We used to have one like this what? Dashboard Minute or something?
Yeah, something like that.
Oh, that guy was awful.
Jumping into the Mac news for this week, Mac sales are up 30%. It's a lot of people are kind of surprised. Vista came out. Everybody was expecting, well, maybe Vista's going to sell well. And, you know, I'm not surprised at all. I don't see that Vista was ever a competition or a serious threat to people buying a Macintosh.
Nope.
You want to read that news story?
So. Yeah, I'll roll through it. Mac sales kept pace with significant growth in overall PC shipments during the first quarter of 2007. You want the base numbers. Apple increased over 2006 from 4% of the total U.S. market share to 5%, which doesn't seem like much, but you got to consider it's a 30% increase from last year. And according to the research firm Gartner's, this makes Apple's market share the fastest growing among PC vendors in the U.S. Toshiba was second with a 26.8% growth, and Dell dropped 15.5% last year, although it did retain its spot as a top PC vendor in the U.S.
Why do you think Dell, of all companies, would drop? I mean, it's hard to, if you're already on top and you've got a huge market share, it's hard to stay there, obviously. But the only thing I can see is that these figures are reflecting the first quarter of 2006 when Vista wasn't out yet. For the most part, right?
That's true.
And so I think a lot of individuals and big businesses were probably waiting for Vista to ship before they went and made a big order.
Mm-hmm.
And Dell really has the business market cornered.
Right.
Toshiba is probably more of a
consumer.
And Dell is the businesses. And the business is simply waiting.
Well, isn't Toshiba's real strength in laptops anyways?
Absolutely.
Not, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, but yes, it... And if you look at what Apple's selling, they're starting to sell more laptops now than
Correct.
They are desktops for both consumers and business people. Business people are really going for laptops much more, I think, than even the home users are. It's
well,
just
today's
convenient.
Laptops are so powerful compared to what they used to be.
Absolutely.
Well, there's a lot of people that just use a laptop as their main machine. They don't even bother with a desktop anymore.
Honestly, you know, I've got a G5 at home, and I've got two monitors on it. And that's the main reason I still use that G5. But quite honestly, for most tasks, I use my MacBook Pro for almost everything now.
And that's basically what my wife uses. She has an old iBook, and that's really all she uses for computing.
And you have a MacBook.
Right.
Where and do you use that mostly?
Predominantly, I use this, you know, unless I'm actually sitting here doing work. I'm
or
usually
using
my laptop to just cruise the internet, catch up on what's going on my Mac.com, see what's going on other sites. And that's
you take
really
it to work with you and stuff? Or
laptop? No, I actually work on a Dell at work.
Ugh,
so.
That's painful, I know. What about you, Robert? Are you a laptop user yet, or are you sticking with the desktop?
I have two computing scenarios. I have when I do my work at home, and I do a lot of work at home, you know, doing all my freelance. I have a G5, and I've got three monitors that I generally use that computer the most to do just about everything. But I do have an iBook, an old G4 iBook. It's not that old, actually. It's a 2005 model. But I only use that really to surf the internet and check my email when I'm sitting downstairs on the couch and, you know, watching TV or something else, you know. I don't use the G4 iBook that much other than for email. So as far as how much time, I would say it's probably a 75-25% ratio. I'm only using the iBook about 25% of the time.
You think there's a market for a sub notebook from Apple, a 12-inch MacBook Mini or something?
I definitely do. I love my iBook is a 12 inch. I love the 12 inch. The only reason I haven't bought a new laptop is because I want something small. I want a 12 inch. I don't want a big computer to sit on my lap downstairs so I could surf the just to get email. I just think it's overkill.
Do you think that the MacBook's 13.3 inch screen is still too big?
No, it's
okay. Not a sub notebook though. It really isn't.
I just want something that's even lighter and smaller and thinner and, you know, just something that I can, you know, chuck
the
around.
MacBook Pequeño.
Well, my wife isn't really happy with me because she's been wanting 12 inches for a long time.
And I knew it was coming. We just told you she'd have to sell for what you were born with, so.
So I just gave it to her 12 times. And
we started with hot wax.
Okay.
Downhill.
Yeah.
There's the explicit tag again.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we know for a fact that some people at Adobe listened to last week's show, and I'm like, ooh, I hope they went directly to Fenestration. next news story is the BBC to release a Macintosh version of the iPlayer. Now, this is actually really cool news. The BBC has announced plans to develop an Apple version of its iPlayer software that allows Internet users to view archived BBC material. If you wanted to view archived material before, only Windows was officially supported. I think this is a really good idea. It's about time. The BBC has some fantastic content, and Mac users simply haven't been able to watch it.
Yep.
And we're all in the United States. I don't know about you guys. The only BBC show that channel that I get at all on my home cable network is the BBC News stuff. I don't get the channels with, you know, like The Office and the comedy shows. And I would watch it if we could, but...
Mm-hmm.
There's a BBC America channel that's on some cable systems that we have. And it shows quite a wide variety of different things.
Yeah, it seems like every time...
Including
Benny Hill.
The old, you know, Benny Hill and Monty Python.
Yeah,
and,
but see, that stuff's played out.
I'm a huge Monty Python fan. Oh, not for me. But I can always.
I want to see the new stuff. I want to see the stuff that they're developing right now that's really good. I mean, how many shows in the last couple of years in America came from an English show?
Mm-hmm.
And quite a few of them. I personally think the original The Office from England was great. I really liked it. But I like the Americanized version even more now. I didn't at first. I was like, oh, this is horrible compared to Ricky Gervais' show. But the new now is just fabulous.
We exported the Apple PC commercials to England, so we're about even.
Well, yes and no. I think I like theirs better, too. And I said that a couple weeks ago on the podcast. At least I like the Mac in the English version better. But I like the PC version of the American commercials.
The PC guy?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I like the American version of the PC guy better.
Speaking of which, did you see the latest one?
Which one is this?
The bloatware.
No. Oh, yeah. When he's
I haven't seen that yet.
Oh, it's funny.
Yeah.
Go ahead and explain it to him, Chad.
Well, essentially, you see Matt going, "Hey, PC, what's up?" And he says, "Oh, just got some new stuff."
And he's wobbling in, and he's, like, huge. It looks like he swallowed, you know.
He looks like the blueberry girl from...
Right, Veruca Salt.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's huge. And they
wobbling in.
And that is a problem on the PC side. That if you get a PC, if you just buy Vista, like for me, I got Vista and I put on my MacBook Pro. There's no trialware or anything like that on there. But if you buy, say, a Toshiba laptop, it's just going to come loaded with a whole bunch of crap that you're never going to use. And they just throw it on there, a whole bunch of crap.
Aren't usually the backup disks that come with the machine, like if you want to just have Windows on there, the backup disks already still have all that crapware on
it? Yeah. Because you got to take
it
back to family.
So you can't even get rid of it.
Right. If you want to erase your hard drive, say you get a virus, which on a PC happens all the damn time, Vista seems pretty secure so far, but it's only a matter of time, children. And you reload them factory disks. Yeah, boom, all of a sudden you got the trial versions of all these software again. And heaven forbid you actually bought one of those softwares from the trial version, and your documentation was electronic. Guess what? That's gone now.
Yeah.
I'm just, you know, it's so hard to explain to PC users nowadays why the Mac is such a superior computing platform. And... it's just, it's so hard to explain it to them because you start telling them about this and they're like, well, yeah, but, you know, you just don't use it or you just get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you don't have any games.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
You don't have the games.
That seems to be their last refuge. you don't have half life. He's like, well, no, I have a full life. Thank you.
And eye life, damn it.
26% of music will be sold online by 2011. What do you think, Guy?
Well, Research and Markets, which is another one of those analytical firms, says that by 2011, online sales of digital music will represent 26% of all music purchased worldwide.
Are they saying it's going to be exactly 26 or at least 26? Because personally, I think they're going to get 26% by 2009, and that's only 2 years away. Seriously.
Well, all they've got here in the article is that, you know, they're saying that it will be probably at least 26%.
They said there's a rising demand for music videos. Is there a rising demand for music videos? How come I never hear when Apple has, you know, a big PR thing or Steve Jobs is up on the stage? I never hear him talking about, and wow, we sold 150 million video or music videos. Nobody's buying that stuff.
If I want to watch music videos, I'll watch MTV.
Oh wait, they don't show music videos.
Robert, have you ever purchased a music video other than one just to see what it looked like with the iTunes?
I actually got one when I bought an album because it was included with the album.
Yeah, I got that with the Depeche Mode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's like watching a movie. Music videos are like watching a movie. You know, you watch it once or twice, and then you just listen to the music. You know, it's like I would never sit down and watch video.
It's not like it was in the 80s. I mean, back in the 80s, watching the video.
Well, it was new then.
True, but there was also a whole culture around it. I mean, the MTV generation, yeah, they still have MTV, but let's be honest, like Chad and I came from the MTV generation. Mm-hmm. We grew up in our formative years listening to music, and MTV was huge.
Right.
So you can't, when I hear 80s music, a lot of the times I see the video. You know, when I hear Sledgehammer, I think of the video.
Oh, yeah.
You know? So.
Robert Palmer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I don't think that's the way it is nowadays especially with rap. What are you going to. Every rap video that I've ever seen a video for is the same. Some guy standing there with cars and women. That's it. They never do anything that I've ever seen. I could be
completely wrong. And waving their hands around a lot.
And shiny sweats with chains and a grill.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's the rap video. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I never see creativity coming from all the genres nowadays when it comes to music video. They just don't put the emphasis there.
You don't even see a story anymore.
I did see one. I don't even remember who it was, but I watched this video. I think I saw it online, of all places, or it might have been even MTV switching the channels one day. And the whole story was this guy was trying to figure out why this woman wasn't talking to him anymore, and he was sad. And,
well, that's original.
Well, at the end, it turns out she gets hit by a car. He's following her, trying to get her to turn around and talk to him. She gets hit by a car, and then all of a sudden she could see him. He had already been dead.
Ah.
And I was like, oh, that's a nice little twist there, kind of the Sixth Sense type of thing. Mm-hmm. And it fit the song really well, and I was like, it took me by surprise. I was like, oh, there's a little creativity there.
It has such a happy, positive message.
Yeah.
There are some good music videos out there, I should say, though. I have seen, there's an online magazine called Paste.
Paste?
And it's Paste, yeah. And Paste magazine has a lot of independent artists.
Are they owned by Elmer?
Elmer's Paste?
But it's a pretty cool site, and if you subscribe to the magazine, they don't do it anymore, but they used to send you a DVD every month, and on the DVD would be a video from a variety of artists, usually about 12 different artists every month, and for the most part, most of it was concert footage, but sometimes, you know, like there was an Iron and Wine video that I remember in my head.
As opposed to remembering in your feet?
On my feet, yeah.
Brought to you by Mac Addict Magazine.
Well, you know, no, sometimes it was pretty cool, but I never go buy it. You know, like as much as, you know, I really liked some of the videos that I saw there on the DVD, you know, I wouldn't go out and buy
$2 for a video. They should give away the videos on the iTunes Music Store, don't you think? A music video should be free. Absolutely. That's all the music video is. It's a commercial for you to like it.
The problem is that they feel that, you know, a lot of people will pirate it and, you know, pull off the audio and then send it all over the world, and they won't make any money and they'll all die.
Yeah, because, you know, LimeWire and the Pirate Bay isn't very popular already.
No. No.
I mean, yeah, even if it was a lower audio quality, it just give it away, the videos. I mean, that's all promotion.
Yeah.
You know, that would help Apple sell more music. It would help the record company sell more music. Speaking of music, and this isn't in our cheat sheet notes, but what do you guys think about the recent ruling about basically internet radio is going to be dead here really, really soon?
What do I think? I think that it's the government. Well, the government's run amok. Our government is organized crime. If you want to control the neighborhood, you pay off the right people, you know. And I just think that internet radio is getting screwed. Terrestrial radio doesn't have to pay those royalties. Why? Because their lobbyists are the ones that are part of this.
Well, and the music companies don't want them to pay those kind of fees. In fact, they just got busted for paying the radio stations themselves to play certain music.
I am shocked.
I know.
It's shocked, just, I say.
It's crazy.
What? Payola in radio? Payola.
Who would have thunk? It's a sad day, but what I can't figure out as far as the music industry is concerned, and they're the ones pushing this, why would they want to do this? Why do you want to limit the amount of outlets that are playing your music, promoting what you're selling? I don't get it.
I think they want to control it. I think that, you know, once you get the royalties up high enough where people can't where companies can't afford to do it, then you as a record company can go to Pandora and say, hey, look, we'll give you a really sweet deal if you pay us this amount of money.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think what you're going to see is a lot of overseas radio stations. Well, no, because people want to hear music from groups that they know.
Mm-hmm.
As much as I would love for PodSafe Music, the independent artists, to start getting the attention they rightly deserve.
Well, no, they're not really.
You're into podcasting, so for you, yes, they're starting to. But the vast majority of the people that are promoting
themselves on MySpace and some of the other public websites of that nature, and there have been people that have gotten record deals just based on this.
Yeah, but then they're not independent anymore. Now they're the big labels, and thus
they're not going to be on internet radio anymore.
Exactly, you're not going to see their MySpace page anymore. They're not going to be giving away their songs anymore. It's, you know, if what the independent artist is doing is trying to get the attention of the big labels, great. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about how are we getting to hear new music. We need radio stations. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to go looking on the internet to find one band on MySpace to maybe try and become their friend and maybe try a couple of their songs. That ain't happening. But if I'm listening to something streaming and I like it, then streaming audio, I can look right on the screen and see who it is.
Yep. That's how I got some of my stuff.
Yeah, Apple has pretty much taken that road as well with the free downloads they do every week.
Well, yeah, but that's one song.
Yeah.
Well, that's true, but it's worked out well for some relatively unknown bands.
Well, but they're not independent bands.
And I think getting back to the point you were about to make, Tim, is that all this is going to do is drive all these internet radio stations out of the U.S. So you'll have people hooking up from Canada, from the U.K., from Australia, probably from the Virgin Islands,
yep.
the Caribbean, who will be streaming to the United States.
Yep, and it won't make any difference at all.
Yep.
It's a crock. It really is. That's one of the things I really liked with the original version of, well, not the first version, but version one or two of the iTunes music stores, you had the internet radio stations built right in.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell you how many times, instead of listening to my music library, I'll go to that while I'm cleaning the house or something and let, you know, an 80s radio station play or something new or the indies or there's a couple of them that they only play 12-inch and, you know.
You're not going to go there again,
no.
Are you?
12-inch, 12-inch, if you're not old enough, was referred to a 12-inch record.
A long single.
A long single. So if the regular song... Yeah. If a regular...
Stop it!
Chance started it this time. So if the regular song was 3 or 4 minutes, a 12-inch would probably be like, you know, 13, 14 minutes. And those were the versions of the song that everybody just loved because they were so much better.
Mm-hmm.
Songs on Viagra.
So I would use the internet streaming radio stations to listen to stuff. I didn't have a, you know, the control over what I wanted to hear or anything like that, but that's how I, oh yeah, I remember this song. I wouldn't mind going to buy this. I really dug it. Mm-hmm. Or, ooh, who's this new band? And then I look at the screen and it says who it is and I go buy it. So where is the music industry benefiting by screwing internet radio stations? I just don't get it.
No, I don't. I think they're shooting themselves in the foot.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time.
No, and they seem to be pretty good at doing that, too. So going back to that last story, 26% of all music will be sold online by 2011. You guys agree with that?
Oh, I think that could very well happen.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't surprise me if it was more than that.
That's kind of where I'm coming from. It's going to be more than that. I think it's probably going to be closer to 40, 45%. I don't think it's going to break the half mark yet. There's too many people that don't have access to the internet or don't have an iPod. That, you know, there's a radio in every vehicle you buy.
Well, you don't necessarily need an iPod.
No. No, you don't.
There's, you know, because they're not just talking about iTunes. You know, there's lots of music stores out there.
Yeah, but you could combine them all, and their yearly gross wouldn't equal 1 month of the iTunes music store, let's be honest.
That's very true.
Microsoft sell cheap versions of Windows for $3 to developing countries.
No, they're finally selling it for what it's worth.
Yeah. Of course, some people are decrying the fact that, you know, that's a lot of money for Windows. I guess what they're trying to do is to get it into these other countries legally.
Yep.
$3, though. Where are they getting the $3 from?
They're trying to undersell the pirates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I don't know. The pirates are going to get it for free.
Yeah.
The people are going
to but they're not going to sell it. They're not going
to
sell it.
Well, the problem is, what is, you know, for us, $3 is nothing to get a licensed piece of software, but we're not going to pay $3 to get Windows here.
Right.
So we have to look at, you know, what's that relative to the incomes of those countries where they're selling.
Exactly. $3 in.
If you make 20 bucks a month.
Is going to be, well, I don't know.
Yeah.
I just pulled that because that name, I remember that name from Superman.
From where, Tim?
The Superman movie, don't you remember? Addis Ababa?
Oh, Ethiopia.
Yeah. Yeah, how much is $3 to a developing country, a family?
Mm-hmm.
You know, $3 could be a month's worth of, or at least a couple weeks' worth of money.
Yeah.
And, well, especially in Ethiopia.
Let me see, we can buy food or we can buy Windows Vista.
Well, I don't even think they're selling Vista. I think this is like XP.
This is probably 3.1.
Oh, yeah.
We're group for Windows.
It's Windows XP Starter Edition.
Oh.
But that also includes, according to what I've got here, is Microsoft Office Home and Student 2007, along with some other educational software.
Does it include the bloatware?
Yeah, you get a
you can bet tree there's some ads in there.
Yeah, you get a trial version of Quicken. somebody was
just what you need in a developing country.
Wasn't it you, Robert, that was talking about Quicken earlier before we actually started recording the show?
Yeah, actually, I just heard a news story just briefly before I walked in the door when I came home tonight that said that Quicken announced they're going to drop Mac support.
This is the 12th time they've announced this, and that would make sense. You know, the Mac market is actually growing. There's a lot of excitement in the playground.
For it.
Yeah, oh, well, let's stop making, we don't like to earn money. Well, I don't understand that reasoning at all. Do they only look at last year's sales, or are they like looking at 4-year-old sales and going, oh, you know what, back in 2001, we didn't make a lot of money off the Mac. We ought to just stop supporting it.
Well, unless they're figuring that everybody's going to either run with Parallels or Boot Camp and install Windows and run Quicken that way on their Mac. But
You know what Boot Camp and all those type of programs are really doing is giving, and I've said this in the past, is giving Window users a security blanket. So if they switch to the Mac, they can go back to the PC and they can still use it.
Mm-hmm.
And let's be honest, a lot of them, if they use it in virtualization, Parallels or what have you, and they start using it that way, they're eventually going to simply use the Mac equivalent of whatever the application is, if there is an equivalent, and they're going to get more and more comfortable with the Mac, and they're going to go, why am I still running this PC crap? I think it's a good Trojan horse for Apple to get more PC users to try the Mac and start using it.
Yep, but there's finally an Apple virus. Unfortunately, it works in reverse.
AT&T to offer rebates on the iPhone. According to the American Telephone or Technology Research and Analysis, AT&T is considering offering a rebate to blah, 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 blah.
They're 50 to 150 bucks off.
I can tell you're very excited about this.
They're not going to do it. You're not going to see any rebate on the Apple phone, at least for a year. And you know why? Because they don't need to.
Right.
Is anybody going to quibble? Well, I would buy the Apple iPhone, but it's $500. Oh, now it's only $350? Oh, okay. No, that's not going to happen. Yeah, and you're never going to see the iPhone for 99 cents. That's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. The reason that they don't have to is because they don't have to.
Yeah.
You know?
If you want our coolness, you will pay our price.
Once you probably see a couple people with an actual iPhone and you get to touch it, that's all that has to happen. You're going to want one.
With hot wax.
With hot wax.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And I am so stuck on hot wax. My brain is just hurting from hot wax.
And our final little news bit, I'm just going to jump into this. Apple or Microsoft calls the iPhone irrelevant to business users.
Hmm.
Stop the presses.
Yeah. Basically, Microsoft has said that the iPhone will be irrelevant to business users because it is a closed device and does not support Microsoft Office. It's a great music phone, and I'm sure it'll be fantastic and have an interesting user interface, Chris Sorensen told press during a recent visit to Australia. However, it's a closed device that you cannot install applications on, and there's no support for Office documents. If you're on an enterprise and you want to roll out line of business applications, it's just not an option. Even using it as a heavy messaging device will be a challenge.
Well, I think if you throw it at someone's head, that's a pretty good message device there.
You know, I've got a little flip phone. It's a little Motorola. I am a business person. And, I got to admit, when I installed Microsoft Office on my little cell phone... And I was using it as presentations on the little one-inch screen. It was invaluable.
Why don't y'all squeeze around this little PowerPoint I got here?
What killed it, Tim, was all the bloatware that was on Windows.
I know. And the problem is I just didn't have enough hard drive space to install the whole thing. You know? But the problem was that my phone got a virus and...
died.
It died. It infected every cell phone within a 54 square mile radius of me.
You know, you could almost just swap in a couple little words here and there in his statements, and you'd be talking about the Zune.
Yeah.
If you're a music listener and you want to roll out a line of listening applications, it's just not an option. Even using it as an MP3 listening device will be a challenge.
That's pretty good. I was listening to the last week's show, and yeah, honestly, lately, I usually skip over our segment and listen to the other segments after we put it all together, and I don't usually go back and listen to our shows now, simply because they're too fresh. I like to wait a long time and then go back, so I don't know exactly what's coming up, or I don't remember exactly
You're up to show 15, right?
Yeah, I just know 16, actually.
Oh, okay.
But the funny thing was that I did listen to the last week's show. And when we were talking about the iTunes music subscription possibility, I'm more convinced now that I really, really do want to see an iTunes music store subscription service. What about you, Robert? Is that something that would interest you?
No.
Okay.
I'm not that kind
You're off the show, goddammit.
Click.
Remember who writes the checks around here, pal.
Nobody.
Yeah, I was going to say, I haven't seen mine in a while.
I didn't say I wrote a check to you guys. I've got to write the checks to pay for all this crap.
No, I'm definitely an audiophile. I have a huge CD collection. I actually prefer to buy most of my music on CD because then I have a hard copy. It's always backed up, and I don't have to worry about DRM.
Do you have a 12-inch hard copy there, Robert?
With hot wax?
No.
Guy can't get over the hot wax thing, can he?
Oh, I'm stuck on it, man. I swear.
So what have you been playing with lately, Robert?
No, I haven't been playing with a 12-inch.
12-inch.
No, I used to
Joe is going
to
get us in so much.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Robert, I used to feel the same way, but now if it's something that I really dig... I just simply burn a copy back to CD, and you know, the 256, no DRM versions of songs that's going to be coming out on iTunes really is going to make a huge difference, I think. I mean,
I recently,
Chad's just sitting here kind of grinning at me, waiting for the next little slip up or something.
Yeah, I know.
There's a euphemism coming here somewhere.
Oh,
I know
it's
it.
There. I know.
Double entendre. Coming at you.
I just back them up to CD now and call it good. Yeah. I don't need to give an extra $7 to the music industry for a jewel case and a piece of plastic.
No, I don't buy my music at a place that charges $18 for a CD. There's a record store in Princeton called the Record Exchange, and they have great prices. So I'm paying like $12, so it's additional $2 plus the gas to get there. Plus, when I rip it, I do rip it at the highest rate. You know, I go to the AAC, and then I use the 320 bit rate, and I do notice a difference, definitely from some of the earlier stuff that I downloaded from iTunes. And you know, I've got some nice Audio Engine speakers here, and when I sit here and work and play my music, I definitely hear the music difference.
Hmm. Did you see who just jumped on Skype there, Chad?
Who we got?
That was Rick Stringer.
Oh.
Rick Stringer from the Variant Frequencies podcast.
See if he'll come and join us.
Well, we're right in the middle of recording a show. We can try to get him in here. You want to try?
Sure. Why not? It's been that kind of show.
Since he doesn't even know we're recording an actual podcast. He probably won't have headphones on, so we'll hear a bad echo.
As compared to all the good echoes.
That's right.
Hey!
Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, Rick. Hi.
Hi, I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, what?
Rick, how the hell are you?
I'm okay. How you guys doing?
We're doing great. We're actually recording a show right now.
Welcome to the show, Rick Stringer.
Well, hello, everybody.
Ask him about his 12-inch.
Yeah.
You had to have been there.
Yeah. When you listen to the podcast, yeah.
You'll understand.
Last time we saw Rick was up at watching the 300 movie in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Indeed.
Yeah. That was a blast.
That was fun. I love that movie theater. I know we were going to go see the
IMAX version.
And it was sold out. And I got to say, though, the one that we actually got into, I think it was just as good as an IMAX. It was huge. The seats were comfortable. The sound was incredible. It was great. I loved it.
It was. Hey, I'm curious. How does this sound? Because I'm on my airport, and last time we talked, last time when I left a message for you going through my airport, it didn't sound very good.
It sounds fantastic, actually.
Mm-hmm.
You guys sound good, too.
Are you on a headset, or is it the built-in mic?
I'm using the whole setup that I use for the podcast.
Ah.
So I've got my my nice microphone and headset going here.
Very nice.
You got any plans to move up to the latest, what is it, the G router? Is that the newest one?
Mm.
I'm starting to lose track of which acronym I have to put at the end of wireless now.
It's, yeah, 802.11g.
Is it G? Is that the newest?
802.11 pre-N.
N. That's what it is.
Thank you.
N. Yeah. They get so confusing after a while.
That's
actually what I'm using now.
You're using the older one, Rick?
Yeah. I've got one of the real old airports. It's not even the Airport Extreme.
Wow. And it sounds great. It doesn't sound like you're dropping out.
That was a B router, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I've got the G, and that works great. I really don't see a need to upgrade to the N.
What are you using, Robert?
I have the original airport, very first one.
So that's what... That you and Rick are using the same one, then?
Yeah. Right off the assembly line.
Yeah. Do you think Apple's gear is usually worth the extra money for these wireless routers that you have to pay, or do you think a good cheap Belkin is just as good nowadays? We'll ask Rick.
I personally like the airports. That's what I use. I have a couple of friends that use the Linksys airport routers, and personally, I don't like the way they're set up. I really like using the airport software for setting up my security and all that kind of stuff.
It does make it very intuitive.
I can tell you, I had a Linksys B wireless router, and it was a royal pain in the neck to set up. Now, it works fine once it is set up, but just getting to that point, it's not intuitive at all. And when I got the new Airport Extreme Pre-N, I mean, I plugged it in, and everything just worked. It's a great little router. And you can get pre-N routers for less in other places, but most of them aren't going to have some of the features that the Airport Extreme has, including the USB port where you can basically just plug in a drive.
In defense of second or third party routers, I have to say, Chad has a Netgear router here, wireless router, that we never really set up. We just simply plugged it into his cable modem, turned it on, and it worked flawlessly. We never had to do anything to it. Now, that's obviously we didn't set any security on it.
No.
But it's a Mac only network, so what do we need security for? And if the neighbors want to jump onto your Wi-Fi, no biggie.
Yeah.
Maybe that would depend on your neighbors.
Well, and the thing is, we're located on a corner, so the only neighbor that could even jump on would be the one right next door. And frankly, we like her, so
she's not a porn whore, right?
No.
Yeah, she doesn't play rap music, does she?
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
For home use, I would agree with that. I'd say that for home use, security is usually probably not going to be a big deal. But I know, like for my office, where we're in this building, where I can, if I open up my airport, I can see all kinds of other airport or wireless setups from other companies all over the place where they haven't set up their security. And I would not want to set up without decent security in an office situation.
Well, I could say when I was up to where Rick actually lives, I went into a little coffee house and opened up my PowerBook at the time, and I saw at least four other networks wide open. I could have joined in. I did join a couple of them, and I was like, wow, these are just wide open. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, most people are ignorant of how to set that kind of thing up.
Yep. But for a home network, I don't know if it's really even necessary. Although with the new ends, because the range is so much greater, it would be a good idea to turn on some security features. I think so.
I know that I've had to, before I had broadband, I used to use the Starbucks down the street from my house, and occasionally I would take my my iBook with me, my 12-inch, and there's an application out there called Mac Stumbler, and it basically just looks for wireless spots, and I would leave my laptop open and drive literally maybe a half a mile, and I'd be able to see all these different houses, and it tells you whether it's encrypted or not, and I'd say at least 75% of the homes were unencrypted, and you know, you basically could just walk right in.
Isn't that considered war driving? Is that what
that's
called?
Yes, it is. Wireless access reconnaissance.
Ooh. Sounds very Tom Clancy-ish, doesn't it?
Well, there's a couple of dashboard widgets where you can actually go and find open networks. Air traffic control, for one. And it tells you what type of network it is. I'm trying to open it up here. Come on, you.
So, Rick, what's your favorite Mac application right now?
My favorite Mac app? Boy, that's tough. I have so many of them that I just love. I think GarageBand's my current favorite because I just have such a good time using that for the podcast.
Now, if they ever come out with a new version, and everyone's assuming that they're waiting for the next version of the Mac OS to ship before they actually ship one.
I hope not.
What are you hoping for with it? Because I was thinking about this myself just the other day. What am I hoping for with a new GarageBand version? I can't really think of too many things that I really want to see changed in GarageBand right now. Can you?
One thing I would like to see it do is be able to save directly to MP3s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be
instead
nice.
Instead of having to go through iTunes to do that.
Mm-hmm. I would like to see it more of a... There's a program that we use called Levelator that we drop the AIF file onto, and it does exactly what the name does. It takes any sharp spikes in sound, and it kind of levels everything out, so you get more of a consistent volume to your podcast. I wish they would do something like that within GarageBand.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What were you going to say, Guy?
What I was going to say, what I'd like to see them do is have Skype and iChat support into separate recording tracks. Right now, you're using Audio Hijack Pro. But wouldn't it be nice just to say, okay, well, you know, here's a Skype input, and just slip it onto a separate track. Or here's even better, iChat. I can understand why they might not do it for Skype, but there's no reason why they couldn't do it for iChat.
I would say that it would probably be better if they would support any application that has an audio output or audio input to import directly into GarageBand. That would be great, but I do see some potential problems with that. If you're playing encrypted music and you bring it right into GarageBand,
yeah,
all of a sudden it's not DRM protected. Although Apple is kind of the anti-DRM copy protection company right now. Mm-hmm. So what's going on with Variant Frequencies podcast, Rick?
Well, we got some cool stuff happening right now. We've got some Flash Fiction we're putting up at the moment. That's for your listeners that don't know what that is, flash fiction are very, very short stories, usually under 1,000 words. And we've got three short pieces we're putting up fairly closer together than we normally do. And then I've got another story we're working on right now that where we've got four other podcasters combining with us for the voices for the story. Should be a lot of fun.
That's cool. How many stories are you actually contributing yourself now? Or are you more falling back towards the just the producer type of role?
Well, you mean as far as my doing writing. Narrating goes?
Well, no, the writing.
I don't write at all.
I see. And I thought that was kind of the idea that originally that you wanted to get some writing done. That was, I always thought that you were, that was the direction you wanted to move.
No.
No, not me personally. It was the whole point to Variant Frequencies was to get my wife Anne and our friend Matt Wallace noticed and get their names out there to show off their writing. And I'm kind of the workhorse of the group as far as getting it all put together. And of course, putting my voice into the thing.
I think it's still one of the best named podcasts out there.
Thanks.
It says a lot with only two words. Mm-hmm. It really does. It's great. If you guys want to check out Variant Frequencies podcast, where would they go, Chad?
You can go to iTunes, or you can go to www.variantfrequencies.com. You can check out the new website.
When did
you guys launch that?
Yeah, I know. I like the new website. It looks great.
The new version of the website started at the beginning of March.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's fairly new. Yeah, that's since we moved to Farpoint Media. Mm-hmm. And that's working out really well for us.
Great. Yeah, I know that was the new buzz when we talked last, and that mm-hmm. you guys going to move to Farpoint Media.
That was easy for you to say.
Yes, it was. After the way the rest of the podcast has gone this week, it's not surprising. Yeah. It really isn't. I know what I was going to ask, Rick. As a design, you work in a design studio. What's the plans for Adobe CS3?
We're looking into what it's going to cost to upgrade right now with 15 designers. It's pretty expensive to upgrade. So we're pricing that all out right now. We will do it. We're just not rushing into it because of mostly the cost, but also we're kind of letting them work the bugs out because we've been through that whole upgrading of the Adobe products in the past. And Photoshop's usually not a big deal, but Illustrator and InDesign certainly can be.
Well, Rick, are you using a lot of Intel machines, or are you still using the G-series?
We have just a few of the Intel machines. All of our desktops are still G5s because we had bought all new G5s shortly before the Intels came out, actually.
So there, you don't really have an incentive to move up to it real quickly.
No, not really. We will. It's just we're not rushing into it.
Okay, Chad was supposed to. I was cueing Chad. I pointed out and said,
I was looking at Rick's website.
Chad's going, what? What's my turn? Well, we do have to wrap it up. We've got two other segments that we got to put in here, including a review from Robert. What are you reviewing this week, Robert?
I believe you have Crumpler Bags and the FastMac G4 processor upgrade I was telling you about earlier.
And I know David David Cohen has
a new fenestration.
I'm done podcasting. I'm done. I know he's got a new fenestration coming up, and he's actually going to address some reader feedback, and he's looking for more feedback from non-English people. By that I mean living in England.
Give him some American feedback.
He wants some American feedback.
That's right.
And John Nemirovsky does have a Book Bites Live.
Oh, cool.
I'm not sure who he's interviewing. I usually like to be prepared. But, you know, this week it's just amazing that I could actually stand up straight.
So, you still have the drive home.
Yeah, but I have to eat now with a bib, and that's kind of embarrassing. So for Robert, Rick, Guy, and Chad, my name's Tim, and we are out of here.
Hello, my name is David Cohen and I'm the London Bureau Chief for MyMac.com. Welcome to Fenestration, My Guide to Using a Mac in a Windows World. Welcome to Fenestration 29. I'd like to spend today's session discussing a couple of pieces of listener feedback that I've received over the last month or so. The first is from listener Abdo, and he sent me an email regarding the segment I did about virtualization technology and the restrictions of using Windows Vista and the Vista EULA within virtual machines. You may recall that I talked about the fact that Vista has specifically prohibited the use of virtualization for the cheaper versions of Vista, and so if you want to run Vista in a virtual machine on a Mac, you need to spend money on more expensive versions. I was talking about the fact that, despite this, Microsoft currently has no way of detecting that you're running Vista within a virtual machine, so they can't do things like restrict support. But I was discussing the fact that possibly they may find a way to do it in the future. What Abdo suggested to me as a way around that would to be to install Vista under a bootcamp partition and use Parallels to run the virtual machine from the bootcamp partition. That's a capability the most recent versions of Parallels have. Effectively, what they do is they take the data from the bootcamp partition and run it in the virtual machine. But you have the option at any time to stop using Parallels, reboot your machine, and go back into bootcamp where, obviously, Vista is running natively. What Abdo suggested was that if you wanted to get round the detection of virtual machines for the purposes of Microsoft updates, what you'd be able to do in that scenario would be to boot into bootcamp, run Vista, connect to the internet and get your updates, and then once you've finished downloading those updates, you can then boot back into OS X and start running Vista again under Parallels. And certainly, I would consider that would be a good way to work around any detection technology that Microsoft tried to put into their Windows Update engine. So that's a useful tip, and thanks very much for that, Abdo. Though, of course, I do hope we never actually get to a situation where we have to try that out, because I hope that Microsoft don't ever start doing detection on virtual machines. The second piece of feedback was from a listener in the UK here called Jeremy. Jeremy was asking a question about getting a Windows machine to talk to a Macintosh network in his home environment. Basically, he's got his Windows machine talking to the network and able to connect to the internet via an airport router. But what he can't do is use the USB port on the router to connect to a shared drive or to a shared printer. Now, what he's done first is to do what my initial suggestion would be, which is to download Apple's Bonjour for Windows application. Bonjour is Apple's zero configuration network technology, and it's the system that allows Macs to effectively see each other on a local area network without requiring any specific configuration. And it's the same technology that allows Macs to share printers and to share hard drives and folders with each other. So on an all-Mac network, when you've got an Airport Express or an Airport Extreme with a printer connected on them, on your Mac, you'll go to it and go to Shared Printers and you'll see the shared device straight away and be able to connect to it, print to it, whatever. On a Windows, you can't do that. And the detection of shared devices on local area networks has long been a weakness of Windows. So to combat this, Apple rewrote Bonjour so it would run under Windows and made it available as a free download. Now, normally, once you've installed that software and you then go to the neighbourhood, you would find any Bonjour shared devices on your network would be visible to you straight away. What Jeremy's reporting is, in fact, that's not happening and he can't see that shared device. What I suspect may be happening is that he's got a firewall issue on his Windows network. Bonjour uses a UDP port 5353, which is a network port that it uses for actually sending information between machines. Now, on a Windows machine, if you have a firewall installed and running on the local machine, then that port potentially be blocked, and in those circumstances, Bonjour will not be able to see devices across the network. The standard firewall that's on our most current Windows XP machine will be the standard Windows firewall that Microsoft finally built into the product a couple of years ago. And if you have that firewall running when you install Bonjour, then what it should do is automatically detect it and open a port 45353 to allow it to work. So the first thing to do, I would suggest, Jeremy, is have a look at that firewall and see whether 5353 has been opened. However, what I suspect here is the situation is, in fact, you're not running the Windows firewall, you're running a third-party firewall, and Bonjour will not be able to automatically open ports in that device. So what you need to do is basically go into the configuration for that firewall,
open it up and ensure that a UDP port of 5353 has been opened on the firewall to allow traffic to go out. And once you do that, you should find that Bonjour starts working again and you can see your shared printer, which plugged into the USB port on the back of your airport router. That's mostly it for this time, though I do have one other thing I'd like to discuss with the listeners. I'm looking to do a new segment on the MyMac.com podcast, and what I'd like to do is to interview regular listeners of the podcast who live outside of the US and are regular Macintosh users. What I'm looking to do is to try and get a bit of perspective about what it's like outside of the US being an Apple fan. And what I'd aim to do with that, if people would like to get in touch with me, is to actually conduct some interviews with them on Skype and have a chat and talk about their experiences, how they became Mac users, and what it's like using a Mac when you're not in the US and you're not close to the Apple mothership. If any of you listening would like to participate in such a program, please contact me at davidcohen@mymac.com. I look forward to hearing from you.
That's going to do it for this session. As always, questions or comments to davidcohen@mymac.com. Until the next time.
Hello, Robert Azarick here. Today I'd like to talk to you about crumpler bags and a nifty little processor upgrade that I installed into a Rev-A iMac and turned it into a G4 powerhouse. But first, crumpler bags. Crumpler bags are luxury bags with a great sense of humor. In case you didn't know, Crumpler makes all kinds of bags. They make camera bags, computer bags, bags that you can use to carry your cell phone or your iPod. But they all have great color schemes and hysterically funny names. My favorite name for a bag is the Dreadful Embarrassment. However, that's not my favorite bag. I have been using the Soup and Salad along with the Sinking Barge. The Sinking Barge is the one that I want to talk about today, though, because it's a very interesting bag. It is a backpack that will hold your laptop as well as your camera. And to the casual observer, it will look just like a normal backpack, but it has lots of great compartments. It has a little sleeve that when you zip up the main compartment, you can stow away your laptop, and it's concealed very nicely. If somebody was actually going to check your bag rather quickly, they might not even notice that there is a laptop inside there. In the outer compartment, there is a little shelf-like type area. And under this black mesh shelf-type area is a place where you can store a rather large SLR camera and two camera lenses. What I find most amazing about the Sinking Barge is that it's just a hair bigger than the backpack that I normally use, but it holds so much more in an organized way, and it does it with some really nice padding. When I first got the bag, I started to use it on a daily basis, but I realized that it's just too much for my needs. I'm not carrying around a camera all the time, and I'm not bringing my laptop with me everywhere, so I actually switched to the Soup and Salad, which is a saddlebag. One thing I want to say about all of the crumpler bags that I've had is they're made with a very almost denim-like material. So they're very sturdy and very secure, and they have this quality to them. Also, the straps that are included on the bags are very rugged and sturdy and thick. One other thing I really like about the crumpler bags is the use of Velcro. They seem to use a lot of Velcro to separate compartments, which makes most of the bags that they sell modular. What I mean by this is if I don't want to carry my SLR camera around in the bag, rather than pull out the camera and its individual parts, I could just un-Velcro the pouch that contains the camera and store that somewhere else. All of the crumpler bags come in a variety of sizes and colors, so it's best to go to crumplerbags.com and sort of poke around a bit and try and find a bag that is right for your needs. Which brings me to my next point, which is the website. It is very quirky,
and very silly and a little bit hard to navigate. But once you get into the product section, you'll be able to navigate through the different product lines just fine. The two bags I was talking to you about today, the soup and salad, retails for about $90, and the sinking barge retails for $180. No, it's not cheap, but consider what you're carrying around in that bag. All things said, I'm very satisfied with my crumbler bags. So next up, FastMac. Recently, I had acquired an old Rev-A iMac. Yes, a Bondi Blue iMac. It was originally a G3 233 megahertz computer. Certainly not the type of computer that you could use to run a modern operating system such as Mac OS X. So running OS 9 was adequate, but didn't have all of the software and security that I wanted before I gave this iMac to my daughter. So what to do? Lo and behold, FastMac. FastMac makes processor upgrades as well as other computer enhancements for Macintosh computers. And luckily for me, they have a processor upgrade for Rev-A through Rev-D G3 iMac computers. Now, installing a processor upgrade in a Rev-A iMac is not the simplest of tasks, but FastMac did supply me with detailed instructions that allowed me to get in and out of the iMac computer with hardly any issue whatsoever. On the old iMacs, the processor was actually soldered onto a daughter card that also contained the RAM slots, which, as long as I was going to update the processor, I may as well install more RAM, and that's exactly what I did. I bumped up the 64 megabytes of RAM to what it came with, to a half a gig. So the installation was relatively simple, and since installing it, I've been rather happy with the performance I've been getting out of it. Just to give you an idea, coming from a 233 megahertz G3 to a 466 megahertz G4, the installation for 10.3.9 was going to take, on the original G3 chip, about 11 hours to install. So no, it definitely was not powerful enough. However, once installed with the G4 466, Mac OS X 3.9 installed in less than an hour. I'm sure that the difference in the amount of RAM played a part in the difference of time in the installation process, but I wasn't about to go back and reinstall the G3 chip with the 500 megabytes of RAM just to test my theory. I've installed other processor upgrades in the past, and I must say I'm extremely happy with this installation. In all my previous processor upgrades, I've encountered numerous kernel panics and fatal crashes. The FastMac iMac upgrade costs approximately $200 for the regular service and $259 for the advanced exchange. In both instances, you're required to return your unused processor. If you choose the advanced exchange, you'll actually receive a processor prior to your returning your old used processor. Whereas with the regular service, you ship them your old processor with the daughter card first, and then they ship back your daughter card with a new processor on it in a few days. I believe they do this type of exchange because if those daughter cards aren't impossible to find, they're nearly impossible to find. And if they want to make more product, they need these cards desperately to produce future products. So just to recap, today we looked at the Sling Barge by Crumpler Bags, as well as the FastMac Rev-A through Rev-B slot-loading iMac processor upgrade. This has been Robert Hazelrig. Thanks for listening.
There's a well-known and respected digital photography and Photoshop author named Katrine Eisman. She's live with us on the line, but before we begin our conversation, I'd like to mention the three fairly substantial books that are sitting in my lap. I've got the first edition of Photoshop Masking and Compositing, author Katrine Eisman. I've got the second edition of Real World Digital Photography by Katrine Eisman and two other well-known authors. And the book we're going to be discussing today is Photoshop Restoration and Retouching, third edition. Author Katrine Eisman, and she has an assistant or a co-author by the name of Wayne Palmer. The publisher is New Writers. The cost in the United States is $50, $70 in Canada, and £36 in the UK. Welcome, Katrine Eisman, to BookBytes Live on the MyMac.com podcast.
Well, thank you very much, John. I'm glad to be here.
Please tell us what it's like writing a book as a solo author versus working with co-authors.
The advantage of working with a co-author is you can, obviously split what you need to do, but also it's really great to have someone to bounce off of. You know, if I run into a problem, I could ask Wayne, and then he would bring in a business aspect to it that I simply don't have. So that having a partner was a real plus and really raised that book up in terms of the professional level.
And it really shines through. We're very impressed with it here at BookBytes at MyMac.com. How do you personally, Katrine Eisman, divide your career and your work time between teaching, writing, and commercial photography? Because we know you are a commercial photographer as well as an educator.
I'm not really a commercial photographer. I'm more of a fine art photographer.
Aha. Uh-huh.
But the being able to teach, write, and take pictures, they overlap perfectly for me. I work on books. I test the techniques in the classroom with my students, and then I get invited to give talks. And usually these talks are in beautiful locations, so then I get to take pictures that I put back into the books. It's very circular, and it works out perfectly for me.
Good. Well, I'm sure a lot of our listeners are very jealous, and if they want to learn more about you, we'll tell them how to do that at the end of our podcast. This particular book that we're talking about, third edition of Photoshop Restoration and Retouching, published by New Writers. It's fairly substantial. It's 460 pages, and it's color-coded by topic on the outer binding, so readers can find the topic color-coded. How did you organize working with so many contributors and their photos? Because there are many other contributing photographers, plus you worked with Wayne Palmer on this book. How did you keep everything organized and know who was what and what they were doing?
Well, whenever I start a book project, I probably spend about 2 weeks developing the outline. And I go through 6 to 10 versions of the outline. And then when I start writing, I literally stick to it like a script and just check things off. So that time that an author puts into the outline is probably the most important time of the entire project.
Hmm.
And the contributors, because they have the book divided into such distinct chapters, and then the outline, the sections, I could literally just stick in like low-res JPEGs in the outline, and I knew exactly where things had to go. I'm very fortunate that so many professionals and amateurs contributed to this book because, of course, the more people you have involved, the more interesting the examples are.
And they certainly are interesting. We've learned a lot from looking at your website, at least I have. You have a dedicated website for this book. It's called Digital Retouch. .org, and I will post links to your personal site as well as to digitalretouch.org. Can you tell us what's on your website, the dedicated website for this particular book?
Well, the website, one thing that I thought was very important for writing this book was that the readers should be able to work along with the examples because you learn by reading, but you learn a lot more by doing. So for each edition of the book, I have, I would say, probably about 80% of the images that are featured in the book. Even if you have the first, second, or third edition, that website will stay live for years. So you can download the images either individually or by chapter and then work along. In addition, I feature very extensive galleries, portrait retouching, antique retouching, contemporary images that readers have sent me. And I explain what they did. And I think that's really the most inspiring part of the entire site.
It's very, very impressive.
Thank you.
Will this book be valid now that Photoshop CS3 is coming? Are all the things that we've learned from your three editions of this book, are they going to be out the window now that we have to learn about the new interface and the new bridge and the new this and that with Adobe Photoshop CS3 that was just announced?
No, I don't think so at all. All of my books are really more concept-driven, meaning you know, there's basic fundamental ways of working. For example, with retouching, you need to fix the biggest problem first. If the density's off, the color's off, you attack those problems. Concepts don't change when software's updated. Now, of course, there's new tools and features. Specifically, the two that are going to influence retouching and restoration the most are the clone source palette and then the new smart filters. That I think any savvy user will be able to take those features and apply them to this book and be able to continue working with it.
Okay, now I haven't tried those new techniques yet because I'm still in love with the clone stamp and the healing brush. How important is it to learn new techniques when older ones are working just fine for lots of readers and Photoshop users?
Right, I understand that. I think it's important to take a look at the new features. And actually, what I try to do is I try to give them a chance. Because lots of times when we get new software, we have this feeling that says, oh, I know how to do it in version XX.
Right.
And you want to get your work done. You don't want to be held up. So what you really want to do is dedicate 90 minutes, 2 hours to looking at one new feature and seeing what it can do. And then make a decision of, I don't need this, et cetera. It's very interesting. Adobe's very open about, you know, their development, and they had that large public beta with CS3. So I think especially the smart filters are going to have a big impact on how photographers and retouchers work.
Good. Well, I better roll up my sleeves. So whenever any new books of yours and other authors come out, I don't want to be caught with my filters down, so to speak.
That's right.
I understand from some PR from O'Reilly Publisher that you have a new book coming out, The Creative Digital Darkroom. Can you tell us briefly what to look forward to in that title, Katrine Eisman?
Yes, that's a book that I'm very excited about, and it takes my traditional knowledge of the darkroom and taking pictures and enhancing images and doing that with both Adobe Photoshop and Photoshop Lightroom. And there's just so much that you can do to a single image to really express the vision the photographer had while they were taking the picture. That we're going to spend a lot of time on just really delving into the photographer's vision and helping them bring that out with software techniques.
Well, so many photographers who have switched over to digital single lens reflex, they're called DSLR, big, ugly, heavy, expensive cameras, don't drop one on your foot. They are faced with the prospect of using RAW. Are you personally now using and teaching RAW techniques mostly?
Practically every day. I only shoot RAW because I want to get the best image quality possible, and I teach it in all of my classes. I teach it in the MFA photo and the undergrad computer art photo program at the School of Visual Arts in New York City. And I think it's important to work with RAW files because of the higher image quality that they have.
Well, going back to our original book, Photoshop Restoration and Retouching, 3rd edition, and of course you are listening to BookBytes Live at the MyMac.com podcast, is this particular book more for professionals than for photographic hobbyists or prosumers, as many of us are called?
I think that I know that the retouching book really has a resonance in all three of those audiences. I know that because of the emails that I get from the grandfather that wanted to take red eye out of his favorite picture of the granddaughter, to the museum director that needs to restore great numbers of images, to the professional photographer that appreciates how I explain color correction. So each chapter starts with, I would say, essential or basic examples and then moves up to the more advanced. So I let people with a wide variety of skill sets learn from the book. So I really wrote it with many different types of people in mind.
Very good. And I'm going to start using this in my classes. I'm also a digital photography and Photoshop instructor, primarily for beginners and intermediates. And one of the things that my students have the greatest difficulty with is the keyboard commands and the shortcuts. How important to you, Katrine Eisman, is it for users to master the Photoshop keyboard commands and the shortcuts?
Well, personally, I think it's critically important to understand and use the shortcuts. And Photoshop was developed from the ground up to really be used with both hands. And the beauty of the command keys, not just that, of course, you work faster and Photoshop's more efficient, is the command keys let the interface disappear.
Mm-hmm.
You have to spend more time with the image and less time with the menu. And I think that's very important.
And the other thing that my students have trouble with are the dreaded curves. Do you think users who have trouble with curves, that can they succeed with layers instead, or is it worth whatever it takes to become proficient with the curves?
Oh boy, that's a conversation that's kept many people up late at night. The way I like to answer it is, do you use levels or curves? And the right answer is yes. The way I teach, I always start with levels because I think it's very good how you can see the histogram.
It's terrific.
But now in CS3, the histogram's in the curves.
Right.
And the new curves have sliders. So I think they've actually made curves more usable. The thing is I always want, you always want to teach these curves very delicately. As soon as the moves are very extreme, that's when people get frustrated.
Yes.
But they're both great tools.
Very good. Well, we're going to wrap up our interview with Katrine Eisman and on the Book Bites Live podcast by giving a strong recommendation to all three of her titles, Photoshop Masking and Compositing, first edition from New Writers, Real World Digital Photography, second edition with two co-authors, that's from Peach Pit, and the book that we are specifically talking about today, Photoshop, third edition of Restoration and Retouching. What is your personal website, and what are listeners and readers going to find at that site, please, Katrine?
Well, the easiest way to see all of my websites is to simply go to katrineeisman.com.
And we will have that link on our show notes.
Thank you. And that really links to the new master's program at the School of Visual Arts that I'm the chair of, and the websites for all three books, and my personal fine art website, and then one website that's dedicated to a serious hobby of mine. So if you actually went to katrineeisman.com, you'd probably know more about me than anybody really needs to know.
Well, you've done a beautiful job. And as an author, reviewer, whatever you want to call me, podcaster, instructor, for me, the ability to go to the dedicated website, which is digitalretouch.org, for this book that we're reviewing, has taught me a lot about how to improve my photography and how you have done an excellent job on creating lessons and tutorials and sample images for your students and for people worldwide who you will never meet and will never even send you an email, but appreciate your work very much. So we wish you all the best with all of your future projects, and we can't wait to see your new title from O'Reilly, The Creative Digital Darkroom. Thank you, Katrine Eisman, for joining us today, Book Bites Live on the MyMac.com podcast.
You're very welcome. Thank you very much.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to MyMacPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the MyMac.com podcast.